case is 98-423, Columbus Bar Association versus Christopher Keene.
This is going to be a short one.
Mr. Wright.
May it please the court, Davis. As members of the court may know, I came to this case very late. And while I've had the opportunity to scan various depositions and review the transcript, I did not have the opportunity to form the record or the briefing in this particular matter. But I have had a chance to get to know my client and I'll make what I think are appropriate arguments in support of the show. I can say with sincerity that this young man is pro se. This case kind of reminds me a little bit of the Ronnie Wingate case. Both are inexperienced but very promising young lawyers. I must say this case has some rather interesting legal issues in it. However, let me at the outset of this particular argument offer a heartfelt apology to the court on behalf of my client for his remarks and Mr. King's objections to the board's recommendations wherein he questions the intellectual integrity of the panel which made the recommendations to the commission in this matter and which are before you today. Before I forget it, I'd like to introduce my client and his parents, Mr. and Mrs. King.
I would say quite perturbed, I guess, by that statement, that attack by him on the system. Your apology for him is nice, but I don't see anything from him saying he really feels badly about that. I mean, that's really an attack on the discipline system, which gave him a fair hearing, gave him all the opportunity to be heard. It's a process, and he attacks it as some sort of kangaroo court. I mean, I think that's, to me, that's about as reprehensible as his conduct, at least.
Probably more so.
Comes close to it.
Probably more so. That's why I opened my remarks with a heartfelt apology for him. What's done is done. I can't do anything about it.
It doesn't express much remorse. It doesn't express, as you know, we look for some remorse by the respondent that they've done something wrong. If they have, this is the epitome of just the opposite of that.
Mr. Chief Justice, I spent probably 10 hours over the weekend, Mr. King. At one stage in these proceedings, or rather the proceedings between he and I, he almost came to tears with respect to what I just said. He is remorseful, it's a heartfelt apology, and I hope this court will accept it. At the outset, I must say that we agree with Bar Counsel's statement of the facts. That's Bar Counsel's case, statement of the facts. And the case is cited by Bar Counsel as to the proper sanctions levied in like cases. It is gratifying, however, to note that the relator in his filings did correct many of the matters which have been asserted in the findings of fact by the commission. For example, my client was completely cooperative during the course of the depositions, discovery, and I'm sure Ms. Davis will verify that. It's in their filings. It was just plain and error by the board when they suggested he was not cooperative. And I, above all people, know what this court does with people who do not cooperate with bar associations investigations. The relator, of course, has made absolutely nothing of the passive contact that took place at a local grocery store concerning the conversation between Mr. King and one of his adversaries. It was just a remark to the effect that both parties were hopeful that, quote, one day this matter would be worked out and the whole matter would go away. That, in my view, and I hope it's the court's view, certainly is not some sort of ex-party inappropriate comment. Mention is made by the commission of four previous charges against Mr. King, which are surely not relevant, as they were dismissed on intake after review by bar counsel, found without merit, and I must say, surely, a dismissed case where no findings surplusage at best, and frankly prejudicial at worst. The findings of the commission suggest that the monitoring procedure done by Professor Lewis Jacobs was, quote, unsuccessful. Nothing could be further from the truth. In point of fact, Professor Jacobs has volunteered to monitor this particular man, and he feels the monitoring process was far, quote, unsuccessful.
Now, let me start taking forward to the fact that these two briefs obviously differ dramatically from reading the rather inflammatory brief of King versus brief of Hope, who I believe both wrote their own briefs. And I came away from them, and correct me if I'm wrong, because maybe you're taking a different position now in the same brief, that they deny that they made the telephone call for the purpose of gathering evidence for their case. Are they still adhering to this theory that they were actually trying to rent for a place in Pope's apartment, or have you abandoned that?
As Mr. Pope's sworn testimony, my client's testimony, is ambiguous at best. In my judgment, they were testing. They were testing. With respect to discrimination, well, discrimination with respect to this particular housing development. And I will get into that, if you will, right now. What this case is all about is the propriety of taking an individual, which of course until 1997 in the informal opinion by the Board of Commissioners was not unethical, and certainly was not and is not illegal in the state of Ohio. Now, I don't care for taking. I think that every member of this court is aware of my feelings about that particular technique. The commission was a long time coming, in my view, and in our view. However, it certainly did not rise to the violation of the DRs at the time the incident took place, which is back in 1995, after this came was 2 years, and Mr. Pope was 2 years as member of the bar. Taking up until then was not only legal, but it was regarded as ethical. Now, that's my view, that is our view, and I don't know what the view of this particular court would be, but I'm certain.
But was the complaint actually already prepared when it was called?
Right.
There's an allegation that the complaint on behalf of this client had already been made, had already been prepared, and they were waiting to fill in the blank space of the
court. The lawsuit. The lawsuit was right. Filed, I believe, it was the next day or two or three.
So
there was
knew,
a lawsuit filed in this case.
They knew before they placed the call that they were going to file a lawsuit on our behalf.
I don't want to put Mr. Pope in that category. Mr. King certainly knew that he was about to file a lawsuit. I can't speak for Mr. Pope. I think that same day he did notarize, after the incident that took place, he did notarize something in connection with the lawsuit. You're correct on that. But I cannot speak for Mr. Pope. I don't know whether he knew about the lawsuit before the call was made or afterwards. Mr. King did, and I was just put it right up front. Mr. King, while he didn't make the call, he certainly was aware, and I suppose in the criminal law, he was certainly accessible to it. Okay?
Let's go back to the taping a minute. You say that up to 1995, it was ethical for a lawyer to tape conversations?
1997, actually. Well, one party consent.
Yeah, well, the law today is that one party consents, but not for lawyers.
And that is the issue before this court, and I'll get to that right now. I think this court, there's law all over the universe on whether a lawyer can be a tester, because inherent in any testing procedure, testing phone call,
yeah, I understand
is the fact that he's going to misrepresent his posture. He's not going to call up and say, my name is Craig Wright, I'm a lawyer, I'm looking into discriminatory tactics at your housing development.
Yeah, I understand this specific thing, and that's been done, I know, on a number of occasions. I just am trying to test. You say that the ethical consideration with regard to taping telephone calls is different today than it was when this occurred?
Yes, Your Honor. I do say that.
And
the first time this state has dealt with this issue as an informal opinion, which is quoted, I believe, in the latest brief, in 1997, and that is a qualified caveat. If this court wants to write a civil law, I'm unqualified, as far as I'm concerned, you're welcome. But at the time, the taking was not unethical. The issue here, as I said, in a larger sense, any testing involves misrepresentation. However, be that as it may, as I've stated, I accept, and I must accept, the relator's finding of fact and the focus on this particular point with respect to so-called testing by a lawyer. I think if one gives a fair reading of the transcript from Mr. Pope, the lady representing the landlord, you'll find the conversation pretty well innocuous. I would agree that if testing is held to be unethical by an attorney, due to the fact that any testing in some measure involves misrepresentation, then I'll have to concede that there was certainly at least a technical violation. I think a technical violation of the DRs.
I thought testing was, maybe I don't understand, I thought testing was when there was an attempt to determine whether sort of generically the entity discriminates or will make statements that indicate they discriminate. Here Mr. King represented a client, and the purpose of this call was to try to get somebody who worked for the rental agency to say something that the lawyer could use in his case against the entity.
That was the primary purpose. I think it was a dual purpose in this, and I want to be fair to Mr. Pope. I think he had a dual purpose. He's going to take that position if he argues in his defense. My client, I think, undoubtedly was looking for discriminatory conduct on the part of this particular landlord. That's called testing. Now, the issue here is whether a lawyer can test. And as I think the court knows, the briefing materials in this case, the relator knows this, the relator has probably conceded, there's law all over the place on this particular issue throughout this country, in all 50 states. You take your choice. I think it's primarily for the court. I think it's an issue that's a very interesting issue. That's why I said at the outset, I think it is an issue. As I said, there is one other minor matter that's in the commission's finding, and that is Mr. King was acting in an unprofessional manner when he was keeping calm the child, Ms. Cantrell, during the course of her deposition. Ms. Cantrell, as the record reflects, did not have a babysitter, could not afford to have a babysitter, and all Mr. King did was keep the child calm during the deposition. The child was 3 years old. Now, as I've stated, I've had three lengthy conferences with Mr. King. In my view, he tends to view the world a bit differently from some of us. I think he's convinced that we should work for a more just society. I certainly join that view. And like George Forbes, in his address recently to the NAACP in Cleveland, he believes that racism is alive and well in Ohio and elsewhere, and of course is dedicated in some measure to trying to help alleviate that particular problem and other social ills.
Well, you stated that he would be able to work with a mentor.
Yes.
And it appears in the briefs that it was tried and was unsuccessful. Do you think that he's able to set aside these strong views? Is it going to be a problem? Is he going to be able to work with a mentor?
I think he's a lot like Mr. Wingate. I think he's an activist. I think the rest of his professional life he's going to be back to the end. As far as his being able to work with Professor Jacobs, I've talked to him. He's volunteered. And as far as the commission's, again, I'll repeat, as far as the commission's finding that the mentoring process was unsuccessful, nothing could be further from the truth.
And Professor Jacobs sees
no problem. Volunteered.
And Professor Jacobs sees no problem.
None. He feels he's a fine man. He has high regard for the shrink. Well, in closing, as I said, I think this man is salvageable. I certainly hope the court will take a long look at this particular case. I heard a lot of argument earlier about taking this and that. I hope that So any suspension in this case would be suspended, and a monitor in the person, Professor Jacobs, or whoever the court might designate or feel appropriate should monitor his work during the next couple 3 years. I, of course, again, I agree with Bar Council and the Columbus Bar Association, Mr. King, should not be suspended from the practice of law. I believe justice requires this particular result, and I'll save the balance of my time. I've got about 3 minutes.
You have less than 2 minutes, Mr. Wright, that's what the white light means. Ms. Davis.
May it please the court. I'm Julie Davis, counsel for Relator Columbus Bar Association. And with co-counsel Bruce Campbell, we appear to support the findings of fact and conclusions of law reached by the Board of Commissioners on grievances and discipline, but to object to their proposed sanction. I'm not going to belabor the fact, except that it is clear that neither Relator or the Board found the conduct of respondent Payne Pope to be a technical violation of the disciplinary rules. Most of the hearing evidence focuses not on the fact of the tape recording, but on the substance of the misrepresentations made in the telephone calls that these two respondents placed on January 26, 1996. And I think that the Board's ultimate key factual finding appears on page 4 of its decision, which is it was absolutely clear that Respondent Pope, with the acquiescence of Respondent King, did question the rental employee so as to induce her to make statements about Ms. Cantrell, which might be construed as slanderous and which might form the basis of litigation. The Board's addendum to that ultimate factual finding is on page 5 of its decision, which was Respondent Pope's pose as a landlord was a sham, and both respondents knew it. That is not a technical violation. If I understood counsel for Respondent King to suggest that that type of telephone call placed by attorneys working in concert to assist a client in developing a claim for a lawsuit that is filed that very same day is testing, then it is Relator's position that any form of testing like this is a clear violation of all the disciplinary rules set forth in the complaint.
Counsel, what if the lawyer should say, it's a business practice, and has some young clients who are engaged in business, they can't afford the business for them. They're pretty naive yet as to how to assess, do they make another step forward, do they invest, or do they expand their business? And the lawyer said, what you really ought to know is what's the competition doing. And the lawyer picks up the phone with them there or not, tape recording or not, poses as a potential customer, calls up a competitor, in other words, tries to assess the lay of the land and give some, really would be non-legal advice, but lawyers give more than legal advice to people every day. Solicited and unsolicited advice on a wide variety of suppose that hypothetical. Would that be a violation? Testing, not for the purpose of instituting litigation, but for the purpose of advising a client to, do you take the plunge? Do you commit capital to this, or do you turn your resources in another direction?
And my answer, Justice Piper, is it may be. Certainly, what you just described, although it sounds as if it's something that an attorney would be doing related to his or her practice of law for a client, it sounds like a very mild form of misrepresentation. You are talking to someone who is not an opposing party, an intended opposing party. You are not trying to capture evidence to use against him to get a managing agent to make a statement against interest without the presence of counsel. And although there is misrepresentation, and the disciplinary rule on avoiding misrepresentation and deceit, I think is a broad one, to avoid disrepute being brought upon the profession, I think that there's a very mild violation, if any, in that example. Whereas this example is much closer to the extreme of misrepresentation and deceit that attorneys can engage in for their own pecuniary interests. At the very least, Mr. King stood to benefit from the litigation that his client was being granted.
I forgot here, did they use bogus names in this? Did Pope use his own name?
No, Your Honor, I forget. I forget if he used a name at all, as opposed to identifying himself as a landlord who had taken an application, which he had not done, from Ms. Cantrell, and was interested in renting to her. The relator does not agree that Mr. Pope's statements in the transcript were innocuous. There were a number of clear misrepresentations and attempts to induce statements.
So the seriousness of the violation depends upon the extent of the misrepresentation, A, and B, the intended use of the information gleaned.
I think those are two standards. Also, just the fact that you're making the misrepresentations to what you know is an opposing party.
Was it unequivocally established what they planned to do with this information? I got this person said something derogatory about
Yes. The board found, by more than clear and convincing evidence, that the intent was to induce slanderous remarks and to incorporate them in the complaint that Respondent King had already drafted. And in fact, that's precisely what happened. Immediately following the telephone call, Respondent King sat down in Respondent Pope's office, used Respondent Pope's laptop, added the claim relating to slanderous remarks, and filed, apparently that very same Friday, January 26th, the complaint which included that count.
And what were the slanderous remarks?
The alleged slanderous remarks were statements by Jill Vogel for University Area Rentals, in which she explained that Ms. Cantrell had been evicted, and she gave some details with respect to the reasons for eviction.
Not payment of rent.
And she made a suggestion that Ms. Cantrell had personal problems and an inference or two, although she really did not go forward to say much more, that there were other issues that the landlord, that her boss had with Ms. Cantrell. And that is what was alleged as slanderous. There was no reference whatsoever in this telephone call or in the complaint as to race discrimination.
I'm wondering is that in the category of just bad pleading. It seems to me, fact pattern you have there, that doesn't belong in the complaint before or after the telephone call. There was nothing really. She was evicted for non-payment of the rent.
Correct.
And who doesn't have personal problems? So those are all true statements that would rise to the level of slander.
Correct.
So no case, period. No case before the phone call, no case after the phone call.
You're right, Your Honor. The fact that, and complainant, University Area Rentals would agree with you as well,
was the fact
that they did not ultimately obtain true slanderous remarks, I don't think has any bearing on what the intent of these two respondents was when they made the phone call and made the misrepresentations, nor their belief that they had obtained what they set out to get and did use it. And Respondent Pope had full knowledge all the way down the line of how Respondent King intended to use these comments. Now, I mentioned that counsel for Mr. King has referred to testing apparently in a very broad sense, as if to describe any form of misrepresentation used by a lawyer on behalf of a client to obtain evidence could be called testing. Relators never appreciated the use of that term in that way, but we completely disavow it. Discrimination testing is something that in very narrow circumstances has been approved by the force. But there is no record that these two respondents were trying to test for housing discrimination on behalf of Ms. Cantrell. Mr. Pope has emphatically disclaimed any interest in testing in his closing argument before the panel.
Let me take you to the sanction. The board is, obviously you know, recommends an indefinite suspension, which does seem like a severe sanction for this conduct if we look at our previous dispositions. And you asked for a suspended sanction, whatever it is we give, I guess a year suspended, 1 year suspended. In view of the statements we have made about the importance of lawyers being honest, do you think in our statements, which we usually comply with, that if a lawyer, if there's a pattern, and there's not a pattern here, but if there's a pattern of misrepresenting to clients or to courts, that the lawyer needs to sit out for some period of time. You apparently see this as somewhere in between the sort of pattern of lying and somebody making misrepresentations that don't rise to that level. I'd like to hear your rationale.
And that's right, Your Honor. It is relator's view that this was a single incident. It was a scam, it was a setup, but it happened once in 1996. Relator looked at that conduct, which had not occurred before and to our knowledge has not occurred after. It looked at what we believe was a failure of candor on the part of respondents during the proceedings. And it looked at some hints of other concerning behavior in the record and decided that 1 year suspended state suspension would be appropriate. Your Honor, there is no prior formal discipline with respect to these respondents, no criminal conduct, and no pattern that we have seen this properly before this court.
I guess I wonder, do you have any idea? We can't tell from the entry that the board, recommendations the board gives us, precisely what their reason is for imposing, recommending such a severe sanction. Do we know from the record?
We really don't know, Your Honor. They state in their statement with respect to their concern about what the recommendation should be, they make reference to a few things that Relator respectfully believe really should not be a basis for enhancing the discipline for this misconduct. They refer to grievances, but of course those grievances never were tested through the disciplinary process, never proceeded to complaint. They refer to sanctions by courts, but those sanctions are literally not in the record, nor were they tested through the disciplinary process. They refer to what this court has already referenced. Mr. King has put some disrespectful and inflammatory statements in his pleadings, and apparently he has done that not just in this proceeding, but in others. If the question is, does Relator approve of that? No. But if the question is, perhaps this is what the board was reacting to, do we have a record of such a pattern of inappropriate pleading or practice before the courts that we should indefinitely suspend this individual, keep him from the opportunity that he has to improve and change the way he practices law so that he can represent those clients that Relator firmly believes that chance should be given by this court?
Does the Bar Association feel that the monitoring of Mr. King would be effective? Are you, Mr. Wright has represented, Professor Jacobs is willing to monitor
We believe that it should be tried. It is true that there really is nothing in the record to support the board's statement and decision that the monitoring that Judge Graham imposed failed. There really is no support for that. It appears, in fact, that monitoring has had success and that Mr. King has complied with Judge Graham's sanction. We believe it's worth the bar's resources or whatever cost needs to be borne by Mr. King to have monitoring so that he won't be filing pleadings that are not in conformance with the rules and so that his behavior is in conformance with the rules. Ultimately, it will be up to Mr. King to determine whether or not it'll be successful, but on behalf of Relator, we'll think that we should try.
Should we take into consideration that he does, at least as part of the record here, perform a valuable public service as part of the consideration?
There is testimony in the record from some of Mr. King's clients who could not find representation elsewhere, who could not pay for the representation, who had civil rights claims, free speech claims, and who spoke very highly of his interest in pursuing their cause. Relator does not doubt the sincerity of the apology that's been offered, nor does it doubt the sincerity of Mr. King's drive for perhaps some utopian truth. The path that he uses to get there needs to be the one that this court and all the courts approve of.
We should also, you would also agree, though, I think, that persons who cannot afford lawyers deserve to have lawyers who comply with all the rules of our profession. They don't get some lawyer who, or somebody who doesn't quite match, come step up to the mark, I assume. That's, we have to be very careful, I think, about suggesting that, well, it's okay if this lawyer is representing clients who can't afford lawyers. We want those persons to have the very best representation. That's aside from certainly Mr. King's situation. But
we hardly agree.
You've used your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Wright, you've used your all but 3 seconds. You may take 30 seconds.
How much?
30 seconds.
Oh, my goodness, I only got 30 seconds. Well, I agree with practically everything that Ms. Davis said. This fellow does have tremendous potential. He has been very useful to society in a short period of practice law. And I would like to, as far as lawyers being tested, I would like to refer the court to Havens Realty versus Coleman, 45 U.S. 363, where you did happen to be a lawyer using a tester. And in this case, that's what we get. I just had one final comment. Ms. Davis, I don't know what a mild misrepresentation is. I guess that's why I said in this particular case that it's a mild misrepresentation. There were some, I would like the court to really read the transcript of this colloquy between Mr. Pope.
Well, you know it will.
I know you will. I ask you again, maybe reread it. Thank you. I know you will. There's some stuff in here that this lady talks about, and that is, as far as this client is concerned, about how she had people in the house who were guns and all this sort of stuff. And there is in the record Mr. King's representation that the rent really was paid, although there was an eviction for some particular matter. I would just like to repeat.
You really need your time.
Okay. I'd just like to repeat my previous plea that I think justice does require that the court adopt the Public Bar Association's recommendation.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.